Hello and welcome to Launch. We are broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host Bill McHenry is AWOL, but we have our trusty producer Lee Cantor here subbing. How you doing, Lee?
I'm doing great. Big show today. Excited.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be huge. You know, Bill, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business so that our listeners, the entrepreneurs, can successfully navigate their launch. And this morning, we're going to be featuring Rick Walker of Falcon IP Capital. But before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure. Our sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
And we really appreciate their support. Well, Rick Walker is a patent attorney. He's a business executive, an entrepreneur. He's got a proven track record in protecting IP and generating profits for shareholders. He's been a member of a three-person executive management team that led the growth from about $100 million in sales to almost $1 billion in 6 years, and that's pretty impressive. Developed a compounded annualized return to the shareholders of about 30% before it was sold, and that particular company had 30 plants in five countries. He was honored by being named one of the latest generation of Atlanta CEOs and Power Brokers. He is the president of the North Fulton Bar Association on the board of directors, and he recently just founded the Georgia Automotive Manufacturers Association, where he's president and CEO. Welcome to the show, Rick.
It's great to be here, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Okay, it's good to have you here. It's a beautiful day out there in Atlanta.
It is.
Okay, well, you recently wrote an article called Innovate or Die on the Vine. Could you share with our listeners just a little bit about that article?
Absolutely. I thought the timing for an article of this type was absolutely right. I mean, we're still struggling through a recession. And I think now is the time for people who have innovation in their heart to rise to the occasion and start, you know, doing their innovation thing. Entrepreneurs have got a spirit inside of them that rises to the occasion in tough times like this. And now's the time. They can get ahead of their competitors. I think that's my bottom line.
Are you saying existing firms should be doing this, or people that maybe had been downsized, now's the time to take a shot and kind of explore the waters?
Very good question, Lee. Actually, both. Existing firms can look at what they have inside, harvest what they have, and try to move further ahead of their competitors, because some of their competitors are still going to be sleeping. And worried more about making, you know, day-to-day payrolls, which is a good thing as well.
Sure. But,
and also entrepreneurs who are on their own or people who want to be entrepreneurs. This is a good time for them to get out.
So even though the economy seems shaky, just take kind of a leap of faith here and go for it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and, you know, it's surprising how many huge firms got started in a downturn of the economy. And it's like you said, the competitors are either sleeping or they're hunkered down, quivering, one of the two. And anybody that has the courage to really innovate and move forward is really going to be on the crest of the wave.
You know? That's right. And sometimes in tough times like these, people start to think outside the box. And even better than that, they start to live outside the box because their business models have changed so much that now they're thinking, what am I going to do to survive? And it's until they face that wall that they finally realize, I've got to do something different because what I've been doing in the past is not working.
Right. Well, you know, one of the bullets in your article says, you know, give employees permission to innovate. Could you expand on that for us?
Sure. A lot of employees, especially in tough times, are going to be thinking that they're being watched very carefully to see how productive they are. If you give your employees the sort of permission to kick back a little bit and to think about new ideas, ask for their suggestions, that's not going to be necessarily the same as asking them to complete that report by 5 o'clock today, because that's not going to be as structured. But if you give them permission to do that and give them opportunities to do that by having brainstorming sessions or things like that, you'd be surprised what you can get out of your employees.
Do you think that most companies are kind of neglecting that resource they have?
I do, Lee, because I think a lot of companies are just hunkered down, trying to make their profits, trying to keep as many employees as they can on board and mm-hmm. not lay them off. And it's still a very challenging economy.
Well, you know, recognition and reward are pretty powerful motivating factors. I know where I used to work, they had an innovation program where if you just sent in a suggestion, you'd end up getting a little trinket. And then if you actually got a patent application, you know, submitted and you talked with the patent attorneys and all, then they actually paid you money with the taxes paid. You know, how does that work?
That's a tremendous way to do it. I've been with companies that have done that, and I've seen client companies that have done that, and it's an extreme motivator. You know, in part, people talk about psychic compensation. That's good. But actual real compensation could be even better.
That's true.
Be it a trinket, be it stock options, be it shares of stock, even small numbers. 25 shares of stock in your company can mean a lot.
Yeah. Now, what would be a reason that a company wouldn't do something like this?
Why they wouldn't give out rewards?
Or just kind of incent their employees to kind of come up with ideas and to improve systems and things like that?
In my experience, it's a cultural thing, Lee, where mm-hmm. some companies, they want people just to be focused on getting that particular
right.
task
job,
done.
Your job is to do this task, so just, you know, keep the pedal to the floor doing that task.
Exactly.
That's a shame. Well, you know, before we talk about IP strategy, I've always heard that business strategy, you know, precedes IP strategy. What's the connection between business strategy and IP strategy?
Good question. The connection there depends upon the company. Some companies are built around their initial IP. So sometimes you build the business plan around that additional IP, the patents, the trademarks that you might have. Other companies start with a business plan. And then you use the intellectual property, if any, as the tool to get you to that plan. So if you have a business plan where you want to be the premier company, let's say in making widgets, maybe the business plan is to be there in 3 to 5 years. How do you get there? Do you incent your sales force to go out and just drive revenues and make that profitable revenues? Or do you take part of your money and invest it in R&D so you can then have a product that just takes the market by storm and you leapfrog up there in a quantum jump of success? So it's a different approach. I mean, you can do it by basic blocking or tackling, or maybe you can find some IP that will really, you know, use booster rockets to get you ahead.
Yeah. I've always heard that the standard answer when you look at IP is it depends. because I know IP can be used as a sword. It can be used as a shield. It can be used to really build value in the company so that you get acquired or get sold or whatever. Could you talk about the different uses of IP?
Absolutely. These are great questions. You can use it offensively to build your reputation in the market. Some companies really don't think a whole lot about patents until, let's say, their customers think they need to have them. Some companies get their patents because their customers say they have to have them to be on their approved supplier list. That does happen. Other companies have patents because it just seems the right thing to do to maintain their leadership position, typically in older technologies where you want to keep eking out improvements bit by bit. That's still on the offensive side. On the defensive side, you can get patents sometimes to maintain your position in the industry. Patents allow you to, you know, prevent others from making, using, or selling your invention, and that's certainly a defensive use. There are hosts of other ways of using patents, you know, to your benefit in a company. And one thing I like to remind clients of is not to forget about the benefit of trade secrets, which are also a valuable tool, and they're just not, they just don't appear. I mean, you have to find out where they are, and you have to protect them. And when you protect them, you have to do so under the rules of the state law. And so you can't just, you know, leave them laying around. You've got to put measures in place to protect those trade secrets. And that's one of the things that, you know, your patent counsel can do for you.
Right. And I always tell folks that, you know, the trademark, you know, it can be forever if you keep renewing it. You know, the patents are, they got a shelf life, okay, where they're going to expire. And people like Velcro, you know, their patent expired quite some time ago, but the power of that brand, Velcro, even when it's right next door to a generic hook and loop fastener, it still sells.
Exactly right. Yeah, trademarks can go on and on. There's an initial 10-year term, and you can keep renewing it over and over and over, provided you're still using it.
Yeah. I think I saw an article recently that said that the Michelin Man is one of the oldest trademarks around.
Really?
Which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. He actually used to have a pipe back when he first started.
That's not politically correct anymore.
No, it's really not. So I read an article, a book several years ago called Rembrandt's in the Attic, talking about patents that you might have that you don't know you have. How important is it to do an audit of discovering what you do and do not have and what you need?
Again, it depends, but depending upon the client, that can often be very, very valuable. You can have clients who have developed intellectual property, patents, trademarks that on product lines that for some reason just have lost favor. They could have been the product line developed because of a certain energy crisis at a certain period of time or because of a certain trend in green technology at the time. And then other things have happened. So the company took off on a different tangent, went down a different business path. Well, sometimes if you open up those files and look at those that IP again, there can be a lot of potential income in there, even if the company does not want to get back in the business itself. It could simply be licensing royalties. So you dig out the IP, the patents, the trademarks, and you try to sell it or license it and try to derive income that way. Some of the largest companies here in the country actually use that as a way of having profitable divisions. They make their potentially make their legal department a profit center.
About that. Well, I know where I used to work, they did an inventory of their intellectual property one time, and they discovered they had a patent that they didn't know they had, that a tremendous market had been built up around that patent, and they didn't know they had it. They weren't enforcing it. It was still in force. And when they sent letters to all the companies that were using it, the response that came back from every one of those companies was, well, what's a reasonable royalty? And they made multiple millions on a patent they didn't know they had.
So tremendous story.
It's pretty incredible.
That could be a whole chapter right in the Rembrandt book.
That's true. That is true. Well, how important is it to keep good records, you know, both electronic and on paper, on your inventions, your trademark usage, and your copyright matters?
Very good question. As to patents, it is very important. Anybody who's been down the patent path and has had to prove up their dates of invention, a patent depends on a couple of things. One, you've got to have a conception of that invention, and if that's in a lab notebook somewhere, or if it's on an email record somewhere, and if it's witnessed and it's understood by someone else, that goes a long way to helping you prove up that invention. And the patent office has certain procedures for proving first inventors. It's called interference proceedings, and they have a big term there called corroboration. And anything that you have in writing can really help you.
What's a mistake that people make in this area that you've seen?
They don't keep good records because that does take a discipline, and it is a little extra work. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get so caught up in the joy of inventing.
That right, they're not documenting.
Exactly, and you've got to be a little bit disciplined about it because you've got a document, and then it's a better idea to get a witness or two for mm-hmm. what you've done.
So every step of the way, you have to document, get a witness, and move forward a little bit, document, get a witness, move forward.
That helps. I'm not sure you have to do it every right. step of the way because right. I think it's a little tedious. Mm-hmm. But I think you'll probably know when you have that aha moment
right.
that you want to document. And then later on, when let's say you have what Ron and I know as a reduction to practice, when that invention sort of comes together, mm-hmm. either in drawings that seem to make sense or in an actual prototype, you sure want to have that witnessed.
Well, you know, with my previous employer, I have three patents where I was the inventor, but they're actually the owner because of the agreement that I had. Talk to us a little bit about what kind of employee agreements need to be done.
Typically, with most companies, the employer asks the employee to assign all of the employee's rights to the company in exchange for the salary that you're getting. And that's very conventional. You know, unless you're a world-famous inventor, when you come to that company and you say, no, I'm going to keep my rights and you just pay me a royalty, it's probably 99% of the time you're assigning all of your rights to your employer. The add-on to that thought is that's probably why it's in the employer's benefit to reward their employees well beyond the basic salary, because I think everybody knows they have to assign away their inventions. Why not reward them in addition to that? So it's a little added, you know, incentive or icing on the cake.
Yeah. Well, I know that whenever there's a downturn, that it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction with large companies as to what they start cutting out. Usually marketing is one of the things that they cut out. Training is another. But then another thing that I've seen is they really cut back on their research and development. In a downturn, what should a company be doing as far as setting up their budget as to how much research and development and you know, competitive intelligence and improvements?
Very good question. I'd recommend that companies that have it in their budget actually allocate some money for research and development. It'll go a long way to getting them ahead of their competitors who are probably hunkering down and not doing anything in that area. It'll bring them out on top, hopefully, when the recession ends. It's an investment. Now, again, it depends upon the particular business type and the cycle that they're in their industry. I mean, although a lot of people believe we're still in a recession, it's not as prevalent in all industries right now. So if you're in a niche where, you know, you're really seeing, you know, awful things going on, it'd probably be worth hunkering down a little bit and investing something in R&D, finding out what, you know, your competitors are doing, just stepping back a little bit to see how you can rise to the surface in that niche industry.
Well, you know, one of the things that Procter & Gamble started quite a few years ago was a concept called open innovation, where they didn't rely simply on their own R&D people, but they actually started looking outside, you know, for innovations that were coming from individual inventors.
Yes.
And that's kind of spread to now where Staples and lots of other companies have actually product hunts where they'll say, we need a new office product. Send us your idea. They're actually open to that. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's great. I think it needs to be fair. It needs to be properly, you know, administered. And there needs to be proper compensation there. But open innovation is a great concept. I think it helps everybody.
How do they do the compensation for something like that? Like, you know, it's one thing like, oh, great idea, and then sells 100 units. But then what if something becomes the next big thing and it sells multi-millions?
Very good question. It depends.
You know, to win that T-shirt and a coffee mug might not be fair.
That's exactly right. It depends upon how good your idea is with that company and what kind of a deal you cut when you go in.
Mm-hmm.
Some companies, you know, in the past would not take anything at all in confidence from any member of the public.
Right.
Now the open innovation concept goes a long way to being fair. And, you know, I use the terms thinking outside the box and living outside the box. You get some people that aren't hung up on doing office products every day, and they come up with some idea simply because of their own use of an office.
Right.
That's living outside the box and coming up with an idea that maybe no one would have ever come up with if their job is to invent office products.
Right. When they're doing those kind of incentives for those people, are they usually giving them kind of a piece of the action of in future sales, or is it a flat fee when they're doing the open innovation?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. It depends. Upon the company. I don't know if you have any experience in that, Ron.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it depends. It really varies with the company that you're dealing with. I mean, one that I know of, you've probably seen the Emery cat that has been on TV where the little cat can kind of...
It looks like a Emery board.
It looks like a little arc, Emery board,
right.
And the cat's over there sharpening his claws. Well, when the inventor came to a company up in North Carolina, he basically had two 2x4s hooked together with sandpaper on the outside. That was his original idea.
Right.
And so working with this product development company, they came up with what you see on TV today. And their model is if they saw the idea and they said, you know, it's got potential but not in this form, we really need to get a better form factor, that they invest all of their money, they actually pay for the patents and the protection and all like that, and the manufacturing and all like that. It's their money, okay? And then once it starts producing revenue, then they have a split between them and the inventor. I mean, part of the money's going to them because they've spent money on
right.
the protection and the manufacturing and everything, and part of it's going to him because he had the original concept.
Right.
And so that's a good thing because the inventor comes in, they don't spend any money, and then they receive royalties, and that's a good deal.
Right.
And, of course, that particular company, they're gambling that this thing's going to be a boomer, and luckily this time it is.
Right.
Because this is this same company, when they looked at the Snuggie, they passed on it.
Right.
So they missed one, but they caught this one.
Right. Yes.
But it really depends on the company how much the innovator, the product developer, has to pay versus the company that they're dealing with.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I know with Staples, the contest they had many years ago, that the fellow that had the word lock, it's a combination lock that's got letters instead of numbers, and it sold a lot. And he's comfortable now.
Okay. Right.
I think they paid him something like $10,000 for the idea at the beginning, and then I don't know what the arrangement was after that. But mm-hmm. he got a cash infusion at the beginning, and then all I've heard is he's going around talking to other inventor groups of, you know, how he's done well.
Right.
That's great. That's a good incentive.
Yeah, it's real good. And more companies are going to the model of give us your ideas, we'll put our money into it, and then we'll split the profits that we get. Mm-hmm. And that works out good for folks. Well, what about trying to harvest whatever IP that you've already got to generate licensing and royalty income? How does that work?
That goes a little bit back to what we were talking about with the Rembrandts in the attic. I mean, if you take a look at what you have, and not so much the stuff that you may have forgotten about, but the stuff that you currently have, there are ways where you can possibly look at it fresh in a fresh way. And I like to think of it as slicing and dicing the market in different ways. You can get potentially different royalty streams from different segments of the market from the same patent. So inventors are very familiar with royalties on their patents. Well, you can get upfront royalties. You can get down payments. You can get fully paid royalties. You can get royalties based on units. You can get royalties based on sales. And that can all come from the same basic product, depending upon who's marketing it for you and what channels they're selling into. That's another way that you can harvest some of those dollars that it might be laying around in your intellectual property.
How about that? Well, if a company is basically out of gas from an IP standpoint, either they don't have any patents or all the patents have expired, and now they basically got to just do a standing start, how could they get going with a brainstorming session with a facilitator or something like that? How would that work?
Yeah, some basic ground rules, and I've used these successfully with some companies. You really need to get management buy-in from the top. You have to give these people permission to be away, permission to innovate. I recommend, and here's just one way to do it. You get them off-site. You go into a conference room, make it comfortable, casual attire. You get everybody relaxed a little bit with the facilitator. And then you start from the facilitator standpoint, structured ways of getting the brainstorming going. So possibly you give everybody a piece of paper, and you come up with a topic, and you tell everybody you're going to get 5 minutes to write everything you can, all sorts of ideas about that topic. Or you give them a piece of paper that's divided into squares. So let's say the piece of paper has 24 squares on it, and you say, in the next 5 minutes, I want you to come up with 24 ways of solving this problem. So in an effort to do it very quickly, the employees are going to come up with ideas that are going to sound silly, look stupid. What I have found is it's not the initial idea that is the successful one. It's when you take those 24 possibilities from all the people in the room and you start to build on one another's ideas, albeit silly the first time around, it's that silly idea that sparks something in your neighbor's head that usually is a successful road. It gets you on the road to an invention.
How many people do you typically put in a group like this?
I like to limit it to about 5 or 6, because then you have some group dynamic issues that start to arise after that.
And are they all in the same from the same division, or are they just random people in the company? How do you choose who gets to be part of this?
Again, it depends upon the company, but typically it's people in the same division, mm-hmm. but very often from different disciplines, because you don't want everybody working, on that same project and beating their head against the wall for
right.
the last several months. So you get people from finance, people from advertising, people from engineering, people from
So they may not
shipping.
Know them each other very well.
That's right.
And that's where you want that kind of fresh thinking?
Exactly. That's sometimes why consultants from the outside are brought in, the people, like I say, who live outside the box, who have a totally fresh idea.
Yeah, well, I think that number 5 is really important. I know in project management that we determine that if you've got a team of 5 people, you can really kick butt and have a really good project. And mm-hmm. you start adding more people to it, all of a sudden the project takes longer, there's more discussion back and forth, and a lot of time wasted and stuff like
yeah.
that. So 5 to 6 is a really magic number.
Mm-hmm. There's some other basic ground rules in brainstorming. When people come up with ideas that may seem silly, one of the basic ground rules is you're not supposed to criticize that. I mean, you're supposed to appreciate the fact that that could be the springboard, the stepping stone to that next biggest mm-hmm. idea for the company. So I've done this in person. I've done it totally anonymous on computers, where you really don't know who's coming up with the ideas. but you have to have some way of distancing criticism. All the ideas have just got to flow very freely. And sometimes it's the...
Is that the hardest part of this as a facilitator?
Sometimes it is, yeah, because you've got to make a game out of it at first. Mm-hmm. And if something comes out, you need to sort of almost make an example out of it the first time that, you know, this is not really in everybody's best interests, and let's try doing it this way. And
right.
Give them an example of how it works. That, you know, first you had A, and you added A to B, and you came up with E, and it was just surprising. You never would have gotten there if you totally threw A off the table.
Right,
right. Well, you know, one of my favorite stories is about how Pringles came to be. You know what Pringles looks like. It's kind of a curved potato chip, you know,
yes,
that fits in a nice little cylinder. The idea came from a person that was working in a factory that was making Dove soap. You know the shape of Dove?
Exactly.
He's like, okay, we're putting a soap slurry in here and we're curving out this soap. What if it was a potato slurry and we slid that thing down to be, it was very thin? That was how Pringles came to be, was working in a soap factory.
Amazing.
That kind of logically just blows me away.
Yes. Very successful product.
Very successful, yeah. And then finally got copied by Frito-Lay's and,
sure,
and other folks. But in these sessions where people are brainstorming, I mean, do you make sure everybody's got 5-hour energy drinks and Red Bull? Or what?
You've already taken them off-site and locked them in a room somewhere. So what are the other rules?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Part of the energy, I think, comes from the group dynamic. But no, it's a good idea. Get everybody comfortable. Get them a cup of coffee, whatever they need to get energized.
Okay.
Hopefully they've jogged those 3 miles that morning and they're full of energy anyway. But
all right.
No, that you need to just be smart about the group dynamics.
What about the timing of this? Is this something that's an all day, a weekend? Is it an hour? How much time do you allow for this to happen?
I don't do less than a day.
A full day?
A full day, yeah. I think you need some time just to get that dynamic working.
Right.
And then depending upon where you want to end up, and very often that's part of the definition that I arrive at with the employer, is what are your goals for this session?
Right.
Very often that morning session can help define some preliminary ideas. And then after that, you get some business input, maybe midday, and then you launch again with some ideas that, you know, even though preliminarily they may have sounded good, you sort of test them a little bit, and
right,
then you try to get around some of the blockades that you may have found.
What's a good expectation when you're? What's a good outcome at the end of the day?
Actually, having a product that you can take back to your R&D people that they can start to run with, so it's just not totally off the wall. It's something that has, let's say, been just generally agreed on by the group that, yeah, we can make this. Yes, we can make it profitably. Yes, I think there is a market for it. You know, you can have a great product if there's no market.
Right. Then it's not a great product.
Yeah, that's a lesson that Ron has taught me long ago. Ron is very, very good about market analysis. You can have the greatest idea, but if there's no market for it, why bother?
Yeah, especially if people say, well, you know, the total number of people in the universe that would want this is about 100. It's like, well, go invent something else.
Right.
That's got a little bit bigger target market there.
You've got to be practical.
That's right. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, there's a difference between an employee mindset and an ownership mindset. A lot of times with employees, you know, they're just learn how to warm a chair and get their job done and everything. How do you get them to really, in this setting, to have permission to come up with these 24 ideas?
I sometimes have been successful getting them to play, and it depends where you are. One of the settings I've used is a large room with several lounge chairs in it. So it's totally different than an office setting. It's not a structured conference room either. It's lounge, very large, comfortable lounge chairs. I've had radio-controlled vehicles on the floor that people can play with for a while, and they just get to act goofy for a while.
So you want to distract them, like, from their normal day.
That's it, Lee, exactly. This is a different environment, so you want people to sort of let their guard down a little bit.
Right.
And take down all the barriers, and especially if there's any interpersonal issues. I mean, you want to cut through all that. And everybody's got to be focused on having some fun,
mm-hmm,
and no criticisms allowed, and you just see where this all heads.
Do they look at it, if they're chosen to be part of this, as this is a kind of a reward?
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, some do. Others see it as part of their job and maybe a more structured way. of doing their job, a structured way that's different than their normal day-to-day
right.
approach. Yeah.
That's interesting. And I assume that this is not a coat and tie affair, right?
That's exactly right. More casual, the better.
Okay, so they're going to be in blue jeans, T-shirts.
So inventors don't wear coats and ties? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's just in order to get into the innovative mindset, I think the more buttoned up you are in a three-piece suit with a vest.
You think it's harder?
It'd be a lot more difficult to be creative that way, yes.
Yeah. A couple of the other things I've done is use music a little bit to get people relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Different types of music, so people start to wonder, you know, why is he playing that? And I've heard that one before. I've never heard that one before. That's weird. You get to people start to think outside their box, outside their imagination a little bit.
Right.
You can play some games with the lights. You can bring in, I've done it once where I did bring in a musician to actually perform in front of the people.
Wow.
And that, you know, he started to create and actually compose on the spot. His creative juices were flowing.
Do you do things that actually have them participating in some creative thing like painting or sculpture or something that gets them thinking, you know, in that kind of mindset?
You could. I've not done that personally, but I know some people who lead brainstorming sessions do that. Yeah. In fact, that might be a good way to add on to a concept that, let's say, is only half-baked.
Right.
So then you start to push that concept by maybe some other artistic ways.
Wow. Yeah.
Now the selection of who gets to be in this group and in this the session, I mean, does a manager or supervisor try to find the person that's always been somebody that's been a discipline problem, or somebody that they know is creative, or somebody that's always saying, why are we doing it this way? And just being an irritant to them, saying, why don't we do it differently? I mean, what do you look for as people that can qualify to be in this group?
Yeah, I would include everyone.
Everyone.
To the extent you want to keep the group, you know, capped at five or six people.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is setting the ground rules up front. I would meet with that manager in advance first to find out what his goals are for the session, and then try to get some information on the people that will be participating. So as the facilitator, I'll know if there's any potential interpersonal problems or any behavioral problems I need to be aware of. And then we take it from there. And then it's the ground rules and teeing it up and making everybody comfortable at the get-go.
So you're not afraid of having the person that's the naysayer, the devil's advocate person in there?
I'm not, no, because I use that as I play off that, actually, because there are ways of, you know, complimenting that person for their point of view because it's realistic sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you work with that to sort of leapfrog to the next idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a great book many years ago called A Whack on the Side of the Head that said that if you really want some breakthrough thinking, you need to have studied a variety of areas. That, you know, if you read about underwater basket weaving, and then, you know, nuclear science, and then, you know, something that Aborigines were doing in Africa, and you just had all these diverse sources of input, that you would do the thing that the Pringles guy did, that you could make that logic leap from what is today to what could be, you know, tomorrow.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And it's really important to find folks that have got really diverse interests.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not be all in that one person, but especially if you got five people that come from totally different backgrounds.
You right.
know, maybe one's into physical fitness and the other one, you know, is just very much, you know, anal retentive, and the other
right.
one's, you know, the guy that likes to talk all the time or whatever. But just having a real wide variety of people with different interests can come up with some really good ideas.
Exactly. And Lee hinted at this earlier, maybe people that don't know one another, who don't work with one another every day,
right.
Bring them together. I mean, they'll have a common goal because they're at the same company, but yet they may not have worked with one another. So there's no hang-ups on what they can and cannot feel they can say.
Yeah. So, and I'm assuming that there's no big bosses at this session, right?
Typically not. But if there is, you need to have the ground rules.
Yeah. Maybe the big boss comes in at the beginning and he tells everybody, hey, it's okay to have fun.
That's a good suggestion.
Actually, give them permission. You're not just here playing. You know,
right.
we're going to get some, you know, good value out of this, but
right.
we want you guys to have fun.
Right.
And goodbye. I'm gone, and I'm not listening, and it's not being recorded.
That's a fair way to do it.
Yeah.
I've also done it where we've had the big bosses present, but I've done that on computers. where everybody can log in to one site and all of the suggestions go up on one board, basically, that everybody can see, one web board, and then you comment on other people's comments.
But it's all anonymous,
though? It's all anonymous.
You don't know which one came from the big boss.
Right.
Huh?
Yeah.
And you don't know what ideas big boss had that you're now making fun of or you're, you know, criticizing.
Yes, that's the stupidest idea I've ever seen.
No attribution to anybody.
That's right.
The only person that knows is the person facilitating the computers. So. Yeah.
Well, Rick, what trends do you see as far as, you know, innovation as far as large and small companies are concerned?
Oh, that's a really tough question. It's hard to determine trends right now, Ron, but I think one of the things that I'm pleased to see is that I think small businesses are continuing to thrive, and a lot of that is based on entrepreneurial spirit. And sometimes, you know, entrepreneurial spirit can grow a business even if there is not any intellectual property there that's protectable. There are certain industries where the intellectual property is not protectable. For example, you can't get, at the present time, copyrights, for example, on dress designs.
I saw that.
There's a trend. There's some legislation that may change that. But there's an area of tremendous potential growth where some of the dresses that are made are really works of art, and maybe they should be protected.
Yeah, I saw that article just recently, and that blew me away. It's like, you can't copyright a dress design? And the answer is no,
right?
You cannot.
You probably know the story, you know, bad facts make bad law, and that just means to me that somewhere 100 years ago, somebody tried to do something, and it just wouldn't fly, so they created the laws that said it can't be covered.
Yeah, that was mind-boggling to me. Well, Rick, this has really been great. How can our listeners get in touch with you?
They can reach me at Falcon IP Capital. My office is here in Alpharetta, Georgia. I can give you an email address and a phone number. My email address is rwalker@falcon, F-A-L-C-O-N, I-P, as in intellectual property, capital, capital.com. My website is Falcon IP Capital, and my phone number is 770-314-9040.
Okay, well, thanks again for being on the show, Rick. Our listeners have really gotten some super nuggets that they can use in their business. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Lee. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Well, another great show, Lee.
Yeah, and special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents & More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And go to our blog at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen again to this show over and over, plus our previous shows. This is Ron Reardon and Lee Cantor signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.